despite some bodily infirmity, we shall try to continue today.
John. All
right. Please move forward, because others will come.
Well, yesterday, we progressed in the introduction to philosophy to the point of seeing that there are two basic approaches to philosophy. And one is our own Vaishnava approach, in which purification of our God-given means to knowledge, and I explained, God has given us the senses, the mind, and most importantly, He has given the Shastra, Shabda, Shabda Praman, coming down through Guru Parampara. So, this approach, the Vaishnava approach, is that these means to knowledge are to be engaged in a process of purification of consciousness. And when consciousness becomes, and Prabhupada gave so many very clear, brilliant analogies. For example, his analogy of entering the sun planet, you may have heard this, that the sun is a planet and there are living beings in the sun headed by Surya Dev, and you and I can also go there, but not in this body. If we try to approach the sun in this body, we'll be turned to ashes. So one has to qualify oneself to get a body of fire, and then one can enter the Suryalok, the sun planet, and actually see what is going on within that planet, just as we are seeing on this earthly planet so many things, so many living entities, so many varieties, activities are going on, so many qualities are on display. Now when we look at the sun, all we see is a great ball of fire, and we can't imagine anything else going on there except that. But if one has the appropriate body, then one will see a world actually much more glorious than this world. But one must be qualified. So this is an example Srila Prabhupada gave, that you can enter fire, but you need a body of fire. So Krishna, God, He is, as Prabhupada said, the purest of the pure. Pavitram. So, Raja Vidya Raja Guyam. Pavitram. Idam Uttamam. There is knowledge by which we can know this supremely pure personality of Godhead. And that knowledge is purifying. It purifies us. And when we achieve that, Prabhupada put it this way, that same quality of purity as Krishna. That's what is required. One must be as pure as God in order to see God. Then pratyashavagamam dharma. Then one can see directly. Pratyaksha. Pratyaksha means direct perception. I am seeing you, you are seeing me. The Prabhupada said, in the same way you can see Krishna and you can speak with Krishna, have relationship with Krishna, but purification is the key. Without that, there's no question. I mentioned yesterday how the pratyakshavadis, those who believe only, and we'll be talking more about that today, but those whose faith, they say, seeing is believing, isn't it? Their faith rests only in sense perception. So they demand, you say there is God, show Him to me. And Prabhupada would reply, do you have the eyes to see God? Now we have only eyes fit for seeing matter. But God is transcendental, so one has to have transcendental vision. So anyway, this is the Vaishnava approach to philosophy. That the philosophy amounts to a process of purification. The tattva, we were speaking yesterday about tattva, vastu, the reality, can be perceived by us when we are appropriately purified. So this is essential. This is the, to give you a $10 Latin phrase. I sometimes present these, you can, they're useful. Sine qua non. This is a Latin phrase. It means without which nothing. Without which it cannot be. So without purification, there cannot be understanding, any understanding of this philosophy of Krishna consciousness. And you, when one is preaching, one is seeing this all the time. When we're meeting new people who have some interest, some attraction to Krishna consciousness, but you know that you have to give them only measured doses of our philosophy. You start off saying, we're not this body. Already that's a big, we're not this body. This is already something very heavy for them to digest. Just that point. This is lesson A. So, along with simply telling them you're not this body, one has to try to engage them in chanting, and taking prasad, and seeing the deity. I remember the first time, the very first time I visited the Hare Krishna temple. I was in Detroit, Michigan, in the year 1971. And I've never forgotten it because I really didn't know what was going on. They brought me into an RT and they have Lord Jagannath there. All I could see was this luminous form of something, big eyes looking at me. I had no idea. And then they brought up, they were waving lamps and dancing and chanting. And then at the end they brought out a plant. And we all bowed down to the plant and began to dance around it. What is this? But by association, you see, that is a basic method of purification. Sadhusanga, satsanga. So by continual association, then purification comes. And then everything falls into place. And we understand, we gain deeper and deeper insight into this Krishna consciousness, philosophy and process, everything. So again, sine qua non. Without purification, there's no question. You cannot, we were discussing yesterday at lunch, the academic approach is to put everything on the mental plane. That means everything is subject to give and take, to discussion. We can accept things for a while and then reject them and mix them up and combine them in different ways according to our mental speculation. This is the academic process. Therefore, there are so many theories constantly coming and going, particularly about Vedic philosophy, Indology, they call it. So there are different trends of thought that become popular, just like with clothes fashion. You see, we don't accept fashionable clothes. This has been our dress style, Vaishnava dress style, for thousands of years. We don't accept different trends in music. One hit song, Hare Krishna Mahamantra. One style of dress, one hairstyle. And one philosophy, one absolute truth. And they're changing all this, you see, in their dress, music they listen to, food they eat, also, everything they do. Changing. This is the mental plane. So chanchala, manasa asthiram, not steady. So this is useless. This is useless for approaching Krishna. And Srila Prabhupada said in a letter to his learned disciple Pradyumna Prabhu that the more we follow the academic line, then the more our devotion will be slackened. So this is a very good warning. One should not accept this academic approach, which leaves aside the concern for purification and just puts everything on the mental plane, and you think because it's nicely there on the mental plane and you can manipulate it, therefore you'll understand. You see? So now this brings us to the other approach, which I will call the manipulative approach. There is the Vaishnava approach of purification, and then there is another approach in which the essential principle is manipulation. We have, again, senses, we have the mind, and we have also authoritative testimony, shabda, and they want to manipulate all this. And Prabhupada calls this, what does he call it? You've heard the term word jugglery, isn't it? So the Vedas are there, the shabda is there, but they want to, what? Manipulate, juggle words. The very nice, picturesque analogy, juggling words. So manipulate the shastra, manipulate their minds with mental speculation, manipulate the senses with experimentation, telescopes, microscopes, you see, spectroscopes. So in this way they think they will come to knowledge by manipulation. So what do the Vedas have to say? So the venerable Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. This is an Upanishad of the main Upanishads. And this is one of the very principal ones. It's in the list of Upanishads. This one is generally given first, comes first. And this is the one that the Mayavadis, they consider this their Upanishad. For all wrong reasons, because it's also a very nice personal, giving a very nice personal explanation of the Lord. But Shankaracharya has written a commentary that has hypnotized them, so they think the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is really the Upanishad of them all. Anyway, but in this Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is Shruti Shastra, there is a statement, Monasaiva Anudrastavya Neha Nanasti Kinchana, which means the absolute truth, or Brahman, is to be perceived by the mind purified by knowledge of the truth. And this is the Vedic process, purification. So, in other words, we're talking of two processes, one which is Vedic, not just Vaishnava, not just Hare Krishna, but Vedic, and the other is non-Vedic. We were speaking yesterday, Astika Nastika. So this is important. So what? Now we will consider what falls into the category of non-Vedic philosophy. So in the manipulative, among the manipulative philosophers in the West, there have been traditionally two great divisions, because we're speaking again of the means that the Lord has given us to approach the truth. So there are the senses and there is the mind. And there is Shabda, of course, which for Vaishnavas is, Srila Prabhupada sometimes would say, actually, we have only one Praman. Praman means method of knowledge. So generally you said there's a three, pratyaksha, senses, anuman, mind, and shabda, the spiritual sound. But sometimes Srila Prabhupada would say, we accept only one, and that is the shabda praman. because the others are subordinate. This is very important for all of you to understand. You know, whenever we give a seminar, a long seminar over many days, we're covering so many points, but there are certain points that really must be understood. That if we don't understand them, then the seminar was not successful. So this is one that I want to stress. We have this Pradyaksha, Anuman, Shabda, but we should not think that they're all on equal level. You see, we should not think that if Shabda says one thing and my eyes, my seeing power, is showing me something else, that therefore, oh, well, there's a trade-off somehow, a compromise that I should make. I should perhaps in this case accept the testimony of my eyes over Shastra. No. This is a big mistake. Unfortunately, there are persons even associated with the Hare Krishna movement who make this mistake. But this mistake should not be made. So, Shabda Praman, authoritative testimony, that is paramount. And the evidence of the senses and the evidence of our thinking, our reason, that is to be directed by Shabda. That is to be directed by the testimony of Guru Shastra Sadhu. So, in Western philosophy, there is something that passes for Shabda. They have their scriptures. Srila Prabhupada said, there are three. He writes in Chaitanya Charitamrita. In the Western world, there is the Torah, which means the Old Testament of the Bible. There is the New Testament, and there is the Quran, which is the scripture of the Muslims. And Srila Prabhupada says these constitute the Malecha Shastra, shastras of the meat eaters. So Srila Prabhupada did not consider them to be very authoritative. In fact, once Srila Prabhupada was in a discussion, he was asked that because Rathiyatra, I think it may have been the first Rathiyatra festival held in ISKCON in 1967 or 68, forgot the exact year, in San Francisco. So Srila Prabhupada is speaking at this Rathiyatra festival. He mentioned a book called the Aquarian Gospel. And he said, according to this gospel, Jesus Christ went to India and stayed at Jagannath Puri and had darshan of Lord Jagannath. So then sometime later, you'll find this in the database, the compilation of Srila Prabhupada's writings and lectures and conversations. So sometime later, there was a discussion, Prabhupada and his disciples, some disciples, and someone brought this up, that Srila Prabhupada, you have mentioned this Aquarian Gospel, quoting from it. But people have said that this is not authoritative, that Aquarian Gospel, actually I looked into this myself. It is a book that was written maybe 120 years ago. By some self-styled mystic, Christian mystic, who channeled, you know, this term channeling, you know, some type of receiving vibrations from the Akash. And then he wrote this book, apparently directed by some higher power. But it was pointed out to Srila Prabhupada by one devotee that this person who wrote the Aquarian Gospel was a drunk, is known as a drunkard. So the devotee was just wanting Srila Prabhupada to clarify this, since he had, in a public program, mentioned this book, cited from it, saying Jesus had gone to Jagannath Puri, etc. So Srila Prabhupada's, his reply is so beautiful, so brilliant. He said, he may be drunkard, but he is Christian. And Bible is also written by Christian. So I accept them both on the same level. And it's a perfect answer. So, Bible and Quran, these are written by persons of not very high qualifications. And therefore in the West, so some centuries ago, one could say that they also had Shabda in the sense of testimony that was considered authoritative, and everything else has to be matched up to that testimony. And you see this in the philosophies of Europe in the Christian era. There is, of course, the ancient philosophy of pre-Christian Greece and the Roman Empire. But when we come into the Christian era, then you have different philosophers. And their whole endeavor was to explain the world because they were busy with science, even in the Middle Ages. They were busy with scientific research and finding out more and more about the world. And so then all this new information had to be brought into line with the Bible. And this was the work of philosophers. Up until about 200 years ago, we could say. And then science became so seemingly at variance with the testimony of the Bible that the philosophers gave up this endeavor and started to go with science. Science became the source of what we considered real knowledge of the world. So the last great philosopher of Europe who is trying to bring knowledge of the world in line with the Bible was Immanuel Kant. You may have heard that name. He's quite a big name in philosophy. And he lived in the 1700s. I think he died, yeah, he died just at the end of 1790, something like that. And it was just after him that philosophy in Europe began to go crazy. He was the last one to try to preserve Christianity in intellectual life. So, yes, in the past there was something in Western philosophy passing for Shabda, but not now. And since the time, if you know, those who have taken Western education, gone to Western-style schools, then you've all heard the name Galileo. And he lived in the 1600s in Italy. So since that time, in the 1600s, this Shabda Praman of the West has been under attack. Its position has been more and more shaky, and then finally, about 200 years ago, they just gave it up. So, in Western philosophy, European philosophy, therefore, sense perception and pratyaksha and anuman, reason, has always played a more important part, at least within the last several centuries, than what they have as shabda. So, now keeping in mind, we're talking about this manipulative type of philosophy, which has no regard for purification. And even in the olden times, when their shabda, their Bible, was the strongest praman, the strongest evidence, they had no real knowledge of purification anyway. They were meat eaters, they were wine drinkers, you know. Who invented beer? You know who invented beer? The monks, the Christian monks. Who invented vodka? The Christian monks. In Poland and Russia, they invented vodka. Actually, when we were driving here from Sri Rangam, I saw a sign here in the outskirts of Salem, Monk Whiskey. Now, all this comes from the Christian brothers in the monasteries. And the explanation is they had their fast days, just like we have a codicil. So they had their fast days. But they found fasting to be very troublesome because they also had their duties to do. They were working, they worked the fields, they did so many things. So they thought the way to get strength and not eat is to drink a liquid in which grains have been fermented. Because, you know, grains is giving the main strength out of all the foods. So ferment grains in a liquid brew and drink that, and you won't break the fast, you won't have eaten anything, but you still get the strength you need. And then they discovered, along with that, there's a kind of tamasic spirituality that manifests when you drink these beverages. It is said that alcohol is the poor man's spiritual life. That's a that's saying. Yes. So even in those days, when the when religion was strong,
along with the
drinking for strength,
okay, the tamasic,
they discovered that there was a tamasic spiritual experience.
Oh, I see.
In other words, intoxication.
Visions.
It's so. My point is that even when religion was strong in the West, they had no real means of purification. So therefore, you see in these Western religions, faith is everything. Huh? Faith is everything. They still preach like that today. They say you can't know. In fact, some of them say it's a sin to presume that you can know. This is one of the heresies. If someone thinks he has some vision into the absolute truth, into God, then he's very highly suspected by the church authorities. This has always gone on. Generally, they end up roped to a stake, to a metal stake in a public square with a kindling wood at their feet. That generally was the history of those who proclaimed to have some special vision into the mysteries. They use this term in the Catholic Church, the mysteries of God. So they want to keep it a mystery because they have no method of purification. And so everything was faith. So that's why it could not stand the progress of European science. Actually, the history is that, you see, in Christianity there was no philosophy, actually. Jesus Christ, he was not a philosopher. He did not teach a philosophy. In the Old Testament, Genesis and so on, there's no philosophy. It's just some description of mystical happenings in ancient times. But there's no philosophy, there's no explanation, detailed explanation of the world. So as European society developed culturally, intellectually, there was need for philosophy. There was need for science. These things have to be there. So what they did is they reached back into ancient Greece and they took the philosophy of Aristotle, pre-Christian Greek philosopher. And he's known in European history. They call it, whenever, if ever you read any book and you come across the phrase "the philosopher," sometimes you may come up, "the philosopher has said," that is Aristotle. He was known as the philosopher. See, so important. So Aristotle, he had some ideas which are interesting from the Vedic point of view. I mean, they don't exactly match up to Vedic description of the universe, but they're interesting in that he said that the universe is divided by the moon into two regions. So there's the sublunary region, the earthly region, in which living entities like us in gross bodies dwell, and we are subject to the miseries of life, birth and death, and so on. And then above the moon, it is a heavenly region. And there are what he called the secondary gods, like demigods. Ultimately, this Aristotle, he was an impersonalist, but I don't want to get into Aristotle's philosophy now, but anyway, he was an impersonalist. His idea of God was an ultimate consciousness, impersonal consciousness. And the demigods were exalted beings that were very close to that impersonal consciousness. So this is something, you know, some simple form of the Vedic description of the universe. Very simple and not very accurate either when we get into details, but we're not going to get into those details now. Anyway, what I'm just trying to say is, so he was saying the moon was the gateway to heaven. That matches up with Vedic accounts. That the entrance to heaven is through the moon. The moon is, that's the Pitriloka, and then beyond that you have the Devaloka. So therefore the moon is of a substance not like this earth. It is of some celestial substance, where things here are gross matter. So this was Aristotle's philosophy, and this became the theology of the church. And St. Thomas Aquinas, you may have heard of that name, he was a great Catholic philosopher, lived about the same time as Sri Ramanujacharya. So he wrote a work called Summa Theologica, in which he incorporated Aristotle's philosophy and the doctrines of the church, and he made a big, what would now be called TOE, Theory of Everything. He tried to explain the whole world as it was known then, you see. But again, it was all based on faith in the church doctrine, and based on faith also in Aristotle. So then it was Galileo who, with his a telescope about the size of a cigar, he looked at the moon, and he said, I don't see any heavenly substance there. What I see is dust and rocks and mountains, just like we have on Earth. And that was the big earthquake at that time. He also saw what they call a nova now, supernova, you know, a new star. Sometimes it is observed that some new luminary appears in the sky. So Aristotle said everything there in heaven is constant. It is more or less eternal, never changing. But Galileo saw a star appear. So things change in heaven. And so the church fathers were indignant. You are going against our holy doctrine. And so they were saying that there must be a demon inside of that little cigar-sized telescope, causing Galileo to see wrong things. They had all kinds of also equally foolish rebuttals to make. And so in this way, the church lost its ground, because Galileo, he started the trend looking at... So they were able to silence him, but then others got their little telescopes and started writing. And so what could the church do? And so bit by bit, the church has had to give ground. And now, as we were discussing yesterday at lunch, now the Catholic Church has fully acknowledged Darwin's theory of evolution. They say they've given it the blessing. And the Big Bang theory, that is also okay with them, just as long as you acknowledge that it was God who made the Big Bang. And they say, you read in the Bible, God said, let there be light. Now the church says, that's the Big Bang. so they have fully surrendered to science. So anyway, getting back to the original point, in the last several centuries, starting with the 1600s of European intellectual life, then pratyaksha, sense perception, and anuman, reason, they have become the important pramans. And shabda, that is not considered very valuable. In a book I wrote called Substance and Shadow, I was explaining that they have this term, another Latin term, ipsa dixit. It means to simply repeat what some authority has said. And this term ipsa dixit, it's a kind of a put-down. You see, this is... if someone is just repeating authority, they will say, oh, this is ipsa dixitist. You see, just parroting someone. They don't consider it very important. So it was the philosopher Descartes, René Descartes. He said, dubitantum, de dubitantum est omnibus, something like that, some Latin phrase, which means doubt is everything. Doubt is really the real key to knowledge. Not faith, doubt. So one should doubt, and one should use one's senses and mind to investigate the world and experiment and speculate, and then come in, so to speak, to new knowledge. So this is so-called progress, new knowledge. A recent philosopher, Karl Popper, has pointed out that he has said that means there is actually no real knowledge at all. He said there's this new knowledge is just coming to replace the so-called old knowledge, but you can't accept this new knowledge as being real knowledge, because you have to factor in that in a few years there will be another chapter of new knowledge coming, which will push out that knowledge that you're now accepting. You see? So what does this mean? This means that young people are going to school and they're being taught so, you know, much complicated science and this and that, and details of material knowledge, and they have to pass examinations, they have to cram it all into their skulls, all this information, and pass tests, go through such great anxiety, you know, that they'll get their degree. If they don't get their degree, then they're nobody. So all this knowledge, they cram it in, they pass tests, they learn all this. But then 10 years go by, and anyway, that's now all obsolete. In 1980, some astrophysicists announced they had made some new discoveries about the sun. The sun, how the sun works, according to their speculations. And along with this announcement, they declared in the press that all that we have taught about the sun up till now will have to be discarded. You can just imagine. All those years before, kids in school answering all these questions about the sun, and then they read in the newspaper, it's all nonsense. And in 20 years later, then that will also become nonsense. This is, this philosopher Karl Popper has observed this. So this means that there is no pratishta, no foundation. And this goes back to what I was mentioning yesterday, Lord Krishna analyzing the worldview of the demons. Asatyam, there is no ultimate truth. A pratishta, there is no foundation. Jagat Ahura Nishwam, there is no controller to this universe. So this is the knowledge of the asuras. So anyway, I'm often going on these digressions, but get back to the main point. Sense perception and reason have become, in Western philosophy, the most important pramans, or evidences. And because they have, again, no regard for purification, and therefore their sense perception and their reason is riddled with the four defects. You know? It is imperfect. It is subject to mistakes. Therefore, it is an illusion, and therefore, it is full of cheating. And so we see in the Western philosophy that there has been a division, a great division among these manipulatists. First of all, their one common program is to manipulate the senses and the mind to come to what they think is knowledge. But because of lack of purification, some therefore, they gravitate to the senses. They become pratyakshavadis, or this is known as empiricists, empiricism. They think the final test, the final proof of a thing is what you observe with your senses. And then there are others who gravitate to the mind, to reason. And they say, no, what you perceive has to be interpreted by the mind, has to be explained, it has to be understood. So that is the final, you see, principle of knowledge. That is a final resort of understanding. So, I just want to give you some illustrations of this, because this may sound to you very abstract, and you may wonder what is the relevance. So, here, I brought some props. So here we have some objects, you see. Objects of sense perception. Things that you can see, things that you can hold in your hand and feel the weight. Things that may have, you know, this has some nice cloth smell to it. You can taste them if you like. So in this way, these are objects of our sense perception. Also, reason is involved. For example, categorical reason. These are two objects, but obviously, we immediately recognize that they're not of the same category. You see, this is a writing instrument, and this is a handkerchief. I wipe my forehead with this. I don't try to write with this, you see. And I don't wipe my forehead with it. So this is a categorical difference. And this is bringing in the mind, you see. So it's unbelievable, actually. I mean, these are very simple points, but this is, it's on these issues that modern philosophy gets very bogged down. Very bogged down. Here, more props. What have we got here? Is there two here, or is there 100 here? Two or 100? If you're a pratyakshavadi, it's two. If you're an anumanavadi, it's 100. Because there's not 100 bills here. This 100 is not according to pratyaksha. I do not have 100 bills in my hand. This is anuman, that there's 100 rupees. This is all in the mind. Because I'm seeing a value to this, which is not apparent to the senses, seeing it in the mind. Now, I'm going to make a comment on this, which I hope you'll find very, as devotees, followers of Vedic culture, that you'll find is very illuminating. The difference between these two ways of observing is quite obvious. It's the Shudra who will say there's two. It's the Vaishya who will say that there's 100. Isn't it? And therefore you can see all of Western philosophy is really within Shudra and Vaishya consciousness. It's a fact. It's a fact. Because they have no Shabda, and Shabda is the province particularly of the Brahmanas. The Brahmanas are the teachers of Shabda. They are the ones who give realization, their shabda, and then the Brahmana is explaining in such a way that it is relevant to all of us. You see, we gain realization from hearing from the Brahmana, but they have no Brahmanas. In fact, they never had Brahmanas, at least in what is known as recorded history. So, therefore, this Western civilization is predominated by the lower mentalities of Vaishyas and Shudras. And you see this everywhere. You see this recently. It's still going on under different names now, but a few years ago, the Western world was divided into two camps, the capitalists and the communists, Vaishyas and Shudras. You see? And a whole balance of world peace was in the hands of Vaishyas and Shudras. And that's still going on. You know, this tension between these two classes pervades everything. So this I hope is for devotees is a very concrete explanation of this rivalry between the empiricists and the rationalists. It's simply Vaishyas and Shudras at each other's throat. But they make such a big deal out of it. I mean, it's still going on today. Modern science has kind of muted this controversy between the empiricists and the rationalists. Why? Because modern science is practical. As I was saying yesterday, the scientists, they don't like the philosophers who get into all of this abstract thinking, all of this intellectualization, worrying too much about questions of why and this and that. The scientists are very concrete. And so they use both the pratyaksha, sense perception, and reason in science. So therefore this controversy has been somewhat muted, but it still goes on. For instance, in number theory, in mathematics, number theory. So there the big question is, what are numbers? Are numbers, you see, things that we count up, you know, that I have on my desk here several different objects, and so I count them up, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six things on my desk. Or are numbers concepts? Originally concepts. And I apply these concepts to the things of the world. You see? And there are many, many arguments back and forth, and it goes into all kinds of things that we have no time for here. But they're still, in this respect, like I said, in mathematics, there's a great division. We're speaking of Stephen Hawking, the crippled astrotheorist, or whatever he is, astrophysical theorist. And there's another British mental speculator named Roger Penrose. And sometimes Hawkins and Penrose work together. Why? Because Hawkins, he's a physicalist. He starts from gross matter and says everything, you see, everything has to be understood from there. And this Penrose is a mentalist. He's one who's saying that numbers, mathematics exists in a kind of mental realm. And sometimes they joke with each other, you know, about the differences. But still they work together. So this shows you how science brings persons of these opposite camps together, and they can work together. So that's in the Western world. This has been a real it's like a tennis game, you know, the ball batted back and forth between the empiricists and the rationalists. The whole history of Western philosophy, European philosophy, follows this zigzag course, that you have empiricists like David Hume, the Scottish philosopher, who said, all we are is just a bundle of impressions. human being is just a bundle of... we are nothing more than what we see and what we hear and what we feel and what we taste, all bundled together. That's what human life is. And Descartes, whom I already mentioned, René Descartes, French philosopher, his position was famous, another famous Latin phrase, cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. You see? So on one side you have David Hume, we are just what we perceive, and then on the other side Descartes, no, my very being is my thinking. And then you have another philosopher, British philosopher, Berkeley, who kind of combined the two. He said everything is a kind of mental experience, including what we see. Everything is mind. And this is another position. This is also, you know, mind, because to know this requires the mind, you see? And then people got very disturbed with him too. There was one British man of letters, Johnson, Samuel Johnson, he's very well known in England. And he was with some friends and they were talking about Berkeley's philosophy. And he walked up to a big stone in a meadow where they were walking. And he kept kicking it with his foot very hard. Thus I refute Berkeley, thus I refute, kicking the stone. In other words, there are physical things in this world. Everything is not simply mind. But that's, anyway. You see, it just batting back and forth. So this has been one of the principal issues of Western philosophy. Whether the truth is finally a question of perception or reason, thinking. Now, the same problem also appears in Indian philosophy. So, you have all heard in Srila Prabhupada's books about Charvaka Muni. So, Charvaka Muni is the philosopher of sense gratification. His basic sutra, Prabhupada cites, is that if you can get ghee, whatever you do in life, but you must get ghee. Beg, borrow, or steal, but get ghee. And enjoy your senses eating food nicely cooked in ghee. Because what else is life for? Because when death comes, the body is just going to be burned, just rot away, there's nothing more. So the praman in this Charvaka philosophy is pratyaksha, sense perception. So that is, we see, this is very nice. I told you pratyaksha means shudras, and this is the shudra philosophy. Just enjoy life as much as you can. And in Buddhism there is pratyaksha and anuman. Buddhists accept only these two. They don't go... I explained to you yesterday. They don't accept Shabda at all. So, Buddhists add to this Pratyaksha Praman, the Anuman Praman. And so, now I want to pause a little bit and talk about the... in Indian philosophy, how Anuman works. So, there is... Pararta Anumana, which means logic. So logic is an orderly system of thought. And so in India, among philosophers, Vedic philosophers and others too, there are five steps of logic. So I thought it's useful to pause and talk about that, and then also look at the Western equivalent to this, since logic is very important to philosophy. So the Pararta Anumana begins with hypothesis. So there's an example. There's a mountain and one sees a haze on the mountain. So the hypothesis is that there is fire on the mountain. So how does one come to this hypothesis that there is fire on the mountain? So the next step is hetu. Hetu means cause. So what is the cause of smoke that is fire? This is logic. You see a smoky haze on the mountain, and so you think there must be fire there because fire is the cause of smoke. And then to illustrate, there's an illustrative example, the saying, where there's smoke, there must be fire. This is universal. Everyone knows this. And then the fourth stage is to review the process, review these steps. So we see again, we look again, yes, there is smoke on the mountain, and therefore the fifth stage, the conclusion is there must be fire there. So these are again five stages of logic, and you can see, as Prabhupada explains in his books, the real essence to this is hetu, cause. And hetu is also a term that Prabhupada translates as logic. It is often translated as logic. So in Western thinking, there is also logic. And the systems of Western logic are accredited to Aristotle, whom I've already mentioned. In India, there are five steps of logic. Aristotle has condensed them into three. It's more or less the same process, but here we have three steps. And these three steps are called syllogism. So you have in a syllogism, three steps of logic. You have a major premise, a major statement or hypothesis. Then you have a minor premise, which helps us to understand better this major premise. And then you have a conclusion. And there are different forms of logic. So I'm going to, again, using these props, explain. And the first type of logic I'll explain is called deductive logic. And this is, should be important to you, because Srila Prabhupada says that we, in Krishna consciousness, our Krishna conscious philosophy, is founded in deductive logic. So what is deductive logic? So there are three steps. And the first one is a statement. The major premise is a statement of authority. Step one, a statement of authority. That in this bag, there are yellow pills. There are a number of yellow pills. This is a statement of authority. Just like Shastra again. Shastra is making authoritative statements. So then we must accept this. This is deduction. First of all, we have to accept this. That in this bag, there are yellow pills. You accept it on my authority, because this is my bag. This is my bag. I know what's inside, and I'm telling you what's inside. And so then the minor, that's the major premise. The minor premise is, I reach in the bag, and I tell you, this pill is from this bag. And I've told you, again, step one, this bag is full of yellow pills. So this pill is from this bag. And step three, the conclusion, this pill is yellow. You see? This is deductive logic. It starts with authority. Now, there's a big if here. If you can trust the authority. That's the big if. As I said, these syllogisms, these three steps of logic in the West, they come from Aristotle. And Aristotle was a Greek. And Greeks are yavanas. So therefore, this is also why in more recent times in European philosophy, sense inspection or experimentation with the senses and mental speculation has become so important, because they don't trust authority. And René Descartes, he pointed out about Aristotle. Aristotle wrote these big books about, again, the nature of the world. Aristotle is the first scholar, they say, in the West, in that he was dividing up the subjects into, there was history, and there was natural science, and there was astronomy. He was the first one to make these kind of divisions of knowledge. So in his book on natural sciences, on biology and so forth, so he has written that men have more teeth than women. You see, and so you can, now for hundreds and hundreds of years, this was accepted as gospel truth. Even in Christian time, because they enshrined Aristotle as the philosopher, I told you. So he said, men have more teeth than women. Now Aristotle had two wives. So in those days, wives were very submissive to their husbands. So he could have asked his wives, open your mouth. And he could have counted their teeth. And then he could have counted his own teeth, and he would have found that men and women have the same number of teeth. But no, he somehow had this speculation that men must have more teeth than women. And so then when European intellectual life progressed to the point where they began to do scientific investigations, they realized that men and women have the same number of teeth, and this totally undermined Aristotle's deductive logic. So now deduction in the West is no longer the favorite system of logic. What is more favored is induction. What is induction? So I told you there are three steps of deductive logic. The first one, the authoritative statement that in this bag there are yellow pills. Then step two is I take out one pill from the bag. Yeah? I'm giving myself away here. Yes. Step two, this is a pill from this bag, and therefore it's a yellow pill. See? So you're supposed to be able to trust that any pill that comes out of this bag will be yellow, because the authoritative statement that all pills in this bag are yellow. But deductive reason starts with step number two. Inductive reason, sorry, starts with step number two of the deductive process. That this is a pill from this bag. And then we look at it. Ah, this pill is yellow. And then we speculate. We guess, we conclude, all the pills in this bag are yellow. Why? Because we have taken one without seeing what else is in there. We've taken one. Here's a pill from this bag. Looked at it. It is yellow. So I surmise that all the pills here must be yellow. Now, obviously, you see. Please be patient. Oh, yes. Now, it may happen that one day I reach into my bag and I pull out, oh, a pink pill. So the essential difference is very important, because since Srila Prabhupada says our process is deductive, we need to really understand what is the difference between deduction and induction. So induction is based ultimately on pratyaksha, on what we see. You see, that is the evidence. So, just like we see everyday crows. Crows, very common bird. And every crow we see is black. So then we can, by inductive process, we can arrive at a conclusion that all crows are black. Why? Because every crow I've seen day in, day out, over so many years, has been black. So therefore I conclude that all crows are black, based on what I have seen. But this conclusion is not coming from a reason why. I was telling you yesterday about how and why. So there is no reason, there is no, no reason why every crow should be black, other than that I simply see day in, day out black crows. So therefore, there is no reason why that one day, next week, next month, next year, I may see a crow that is white. You see? It could happen. There might be an albino crow. You see? So, and then my whole theory is then turned upside down. You see? And based on my sense perception, I've said all crows are black, but it may come any time in the future that we'll see an albino crow. And so all theories turned upside down. Whereas deductive logic is based, again, on a reason why. You see, there is an authoritative statement. Again, using this example. I say, because this is my bag and I know what's inside it, all pills in this bag are yellow. That's your reason why. And this is ultimately the Krishna conscious philosophy. And this is what Srila Prabhupada says, because Krishna says. Because Krishna says, therefore. And we have to understand everything in that way. And therefore, this is very useful for ourselves as devotees. For example, in putting questions, Srila Prabhupada said so many times that we should put forward intelligent questions. Just like there was that book, Perfect Questions, Perfect Answers. The Srimad Bhagavatam is coming to us out of the interaction between Shukadeva Goswami and Maharaj Parikshit. Maharaj Parikshit was putting relevant questions, serious questions, not foolish questions, not silly, challenging questions, but serious questions into the nature of the Absolute Truth. So, this is essential. We have to, in our spiritual life, distinguish between serious thought processes and silly, extraneous, unimportant thought processes. So, everything is based on this authority, Krishna, the Absolute Truth, what Krishna says, and so in that light, we should make our inquiry. Questions like, Maharaj, why does Lord Krishna wear peacock feather and crown instead of baseball cap? This is not an intelligent question. Why does Krishna play flute instead of electric guitar? This is not an intelligent question. Because Krishna is the Absolute Truth. And so we should understand the Absolute Truth, but on Lord Krishna's terms, according to Lord Krishna's explanation. It is fruitless. Like I was saying, there are some who ask questions that begin, why didn't? This is another form. Why doesn't Krishna wear a baseball cap? You see? So you're opening the door to a whole realm of idle speculation, useless speculation. What is the point of such kind of inquiry? Therefore, questions and answers come to us by way of what? Guru Parampara. There is a tradition, and that tradition is to be followed. And this is how, by this following the tradition, the system of Guru Parampara, then we are connected to the Absolute Truth. And Srila Prabhupada gives the example of like electrical connection. You see? It's just like there's examples Prabhupada gave of the, for example, of the post box. Isn't it? The government has a post box. Now, it's foolish to ask, why should I use only that post box? I'll make my own. Now, of course, this may represent some you know, determination, endeavor, inventiveness, all of that. Someone makes his own postbox. He puts it out and puts letters in it, expecting that the mailman will pick them up. But the mailman won't pick them up because it's not authorized. Similarly, we have a PowerPoint in the wall. You see? And if I want to run my computer, I have to plug in that. I can't just take hammer and chisel and knock two holes in the wall. You know, when the Russian army came to Berlin at the end of the Second World War, when they entered Berlin, many of the Russian troops, they were from the Asian part of the Soviet Union. And they had never seen light bulb before. You see, it was amazing. So they were going into places, flicking, oh, light bulb, light coming from this glass bulb. And flicking it on, flicking it off, amazed. And then they would unscrew and keep in their pocket. They were thinking, I'll go home to my, my little stone hut in Tajikistan and just screw this in, you know, to the wooden rafters of my house, and light will come. Maybe I'll also have to make some little wooden on-off thing that I can. But no understanding of the system of electricity. You see? So this type of thought process is useless. It's fruitless. Nishpal. So you see, this is the importance of deductive logic, that it is based on authority. And if you don't have that, if you don't have a genuine authority, Krishna and Krishna's bona fide representative, then what you will get is some makeshift authority, some homemade, concocted authority. That's what happens. In Western philosophy, you see all of these different systems, rationalism or empiricism, communism, nihilism, all these different isms, that you trace them back to some person, some philosopher, who gave these principles, and then those who adhere to this philosophy, they honor those principles. Like all the Marxists, you see? Marx is their acharya, Karl Marx. If one is a Marxist, you have to accept that, for example, Karl Marx's doctrine of history. This idea of history coming in these different stages of primitive communism and then feudalism, and I forgot, there's these different stages, then finally there'll be the revolution and then pure communism at the end. So you have to accept this. If you quibble, if you say, no, I don't accept these stages, then you cannot be a Marxist. Then you belong to some other philosophy. So all philosophy is like that. It's ultimately rooted in authority. But if we do not accept the genuine authority, God, Krishna, and Guru Parampara, then what? Then we are cheated. Then we're accepting some bogus authority. Those who are pratyakshavadi, they're accepting the bogus authority of the senses. Those who are anumanavadi are accepting the bogus authority of the mind. So this is essential. This is a very important lesson. Deductive logic. So, what time is it now? 11:30. What?
I forgot to remind you that the TV program at 12 o'clock.
TV program? At 12 o'clock?
Can I come in here?
No, it's just the opposite building.
Oh, I have to give a TV program at 12 o'clock. Okay. Well, there are a few more points to cover, but my perception, my pratyaksha, is that we have probably covered enough now, and we can open for a little bit of discussion because we have to leave for this program. Yes, Maharaj?
From this vantage point in history, it seems astonishing that Aristotle could get away with saying something that the universe is divided into two regions, the superlunar and the sublunar. On what basis did he say it? Was just some idea he had, or why did people accept it? Were they just so primitive in philosophy they just accepted it as he said it, or what?
No, because you see, prior to the Greeks, these Greek philosophers that we know of, there is and now when it is looked upon, they say the very little-known, hazy sort of culture even before that time. And evidence is there of a civilization even before the known Greek civilization, and that civilization is apparently connected to the civilization of ancient Egypt and the ancient world. And this will take us back ultimately to Vedic civilization. So these philosophers, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, you see, they appeared at a time when there had been some break in the continuity of Greek civilization. There was this old civilization in which, you know, they will say it's a mythical civilization, a time of gods and men mingling together, and all just old stories. So the philosophers that we know of now appeared at a time of crisis of faith in this old account of the world. You know, people no longer were able to access that. And that, I think, so this is a seminar on philosophy, so speculation is to some degree allowed. So that, I think, is the break between Kali Yuga and Dwapara Yuga. There's a break. In Dwapara Yuga, we can read from Mahabharata, the demigods were coming to earth, men could see it, and after Kali Yuga, that no longer occurred. So the philosophers were there to then take account of this, so to speak, new world, Kali Yuga world, and try to explain it. And yet still there were traditions left over from the previous age. So Aristotle, in describing the universe in that way, was referring to older Shastric knowledge. And he was just explaining it according to his philosophical conception. And you find a lot of this going on when you go back and look at these older philosophers. They are taking knowledge, we would almost say prehistoric, because in terms of what people know today, it's not really clear where these ancient ideas come from. Now, as devotees, as adherents of Vedic knowledge and Srila Prabhupada's explanation of Vedic civilization, we would say ultimately these ideas are coming from India, from the Vedas, and spread to the West. For example, the Kshatriyas driven out of India by Parashuram. Srila Prabhupada, they said they settled and founded the civilizations of Egypt and ancient Greece and so on. So there was some remnant of that knowledge there. And these philosophers, they're later philosophers. Now, in modern times we say they're the first philosophers, but they were actually later than some earlier civilization of which not much is known now. And so they took nuggets of wisdom and then speculated on it.
For him to say that, there must have been some kind of at least rudimentary cosmological knowledge or theories or something like that.
Yes. The farther back you go in looking at what we can see of knowledge in the Western world, the more it looks Vedic. That's for sure. But with Kali Yuga, they lost touch with the process of realizing. So therefore they have this term, mythology. Mythology just means some fantastical stories which we can't make head nor tails of. It makes no sense to us now, so it just must be something like the stories you tell children, you know, to help them go to sleep at night. Just fairy stories, they say.
The ancient Greek epics were taken very seriously by that. The Iliad, that was considered history rather than fairy stories.
Well, you see, yes. That is...
Can everyone hear what I'm saying?
The Iliad, the Odyssey, the so-called mythology of ancient Greece, that was left over from something previous. There were authors like Homer and Hesiod who were kind of writing down. They were sort of like Mlecha Vyasadevs, writing down whatever was left from this previous stage of Greek civilization. And for a while that was accepted, but these philosophers, like Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and there were others, Heraclitus, so many, what they were doing, and they were calling that into question in different ways. Some were more sympathetic, but thought it has to be explained, you know, in some rational, logical way. And others were totally dismissive. And they said, this doesn't, these old stories don't explain anything. There were philosophers from one part of Greece called Ionia, who were totally materialists. They were the, like, proto-scientists. They were saying that you won't find any reasonable explanation for the beginning of the world in any of these stories. And then there are different of them. Some were saying everything began from fire. In other words, you know, the material element fire. And they were trying to argue a physics. Some, you can imagine what kind of primitive physics it was. But they're explaining how everything evolved out of fire, everything evolved out of air, someone else, everything evolved out of water. So this was totally at odds with the so-called mythology.
It would seem that in philosophy and the history of the world, they're like, even though different philosophers and philosophies come up in different eras and different places, there seem to be some general patterns. Just like it seems in ancient Greece there was something resembling Shabda, it was accepted as authority, and then people questioned that, and then we came up with the equivalent of modern scientific outlook.
Yes. Yes, and
we find that in the Shastra also. There's a little bit.
Yes, this is a very nice point Maurice brought up, and we can consider how perfect the Vedic system of philosophy and culture is. Everything in the Vedic system of knowledge, everything is deductive. Everything is based on authority, whereas you don't have that in the West. What you have in the West, there was a beginning authority which then thinkers later on rebelled against. And then they tried to come up with their own theories. But in the Vedic system of knowledge, you have two divisions of vidya, apara and para. So you have Vedic books about the material world, about mundane affairs, concerning social organization, grihastha life, all of these things, varnashram dharma. And this is called apara vidya. It is Vedic, which means this is giving you the knowledge of how to conduct your human affairs in the mode of goodness. And this way you avoid sin, you avoid falling down, wasting this human form of life. So aparavidya is the Vedic remedy for avidya, total ignorance in human affairs. But after one performs these Vedic duties, these Vedic sacrifices for dharma, artha, kam, in material purposes, then one becomes frustrated, one reaches the end of one's enthusiasm in these affairs, and one begins to, what, speculate. One begins to ask questions, is there anything more? So then, but instead of then that, these inquiring minds having to just rebel, break free, get out, you know, this of the constraints of the aparavidya, there is paravidya provided. You have the Upanishads, you have Vedanta Sutra, and ultimately we have Srimad Bhagavatam. So then the Vedanta Sutra begins Atato Brahma Jignasha. Now is the time. And the purport to this is this now. Now is the time means now that you have completed your materialistic education and all your materialistic duties under Vedic injunction, now is the time to inquire into something higher, Brahma. And so then there is a whole parampara, systematic process for making that inquiry and coming into the metaphysical realm of knowledge, beyond the physical world. But in the West they don't have this. Because the human mind is there, and the human mind is created by God for this. Therefore in the West, as you say, you find the same patterns. But it's not authoritative. It's just, they're just searching, they're just trying to achieve liberation. This Jaksharang, he's also saying that the aim of philosophy in his book, the aim of philosophy is freedom. All philosophers are looking for freedom. Freedom means moksha. But in Vedic culture, there is a systematic path for going through dharma, artha, kam, moksha, bhakti. And in the West, they don't have system. Just like Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, everywhere in the world, you'll see the four varnas. But only in India, under Vedic culture, are they scientific. You find in the West also some equivalent to brahmanas. You see some drunken meat-eating priest. But this is not, scientifically speaking, he's not a brahman. But he's occupying a sort of equivalent position. And Kshatriya and Vaishya, Shudra, all muddled up. Muddled up with ignorance. Yes?
I can't help but tell you that just on the way in the train here, I met one man who told me that there are white crows.
There are white crows.
Is that the kind of area around Kailash?
Area around?
Sarova,
Island.
Kailash, up in the Himalayas. The crows are white.
Okay. That is deductive.
Would you accept it or
something? There is known that there is two kinds of speculation. So one is real speculation of mind, and the other is so-called philosophical speculation. So can you elaborate on that?
There's a good point. His question is, because actually Srila Prabhupada made this distinction between what Prabhupada called mental speculation and philosophical speculation. So this is good to know, because we all take vow when we are initiated of four regulative principles, and one of them is no speculation, no gambling speculation. So what does that mean? Does that mean no thinking at all? No, Prabhupada explained. There is philosophical speculation. That means you use the mind in anuman, because this is one of our evidences, this is one of our pramans, anuman. But it is thought, it is reason that is in line with the Shastric conclusion. You see, one should not use one's thinking to go off the track of Shastric conclusion. One should find a way by one's thinking to realize better for oneself the statements of Shastra. And Prabhupada gave a nice example. Krishna says, I am the taste of water. So Srila Prabhupada said, when you drink water, you should speculate. How is this Krishna? Mm-hmm. You should consider this experience of the taste of water and think about Krishna and try to understand how this is Krishna. And this is appropriate anuman. This is an anuman which is appropriate for devotees. And one, because this is approved, this is the approved use of anuman, therefore one will gain realization by Krishna's grace. There's an example, Shakachandra Nyaya. And actually I had experience of this when I was in Delhi. I've heard of this, Prabhupada explains this, but I was always wondering, what does it really look like? This is the example of seeing the moon through the branches of a tree. So I was in Delhi one evening in a rickshaw, auto rickshaw, and the auto rickshaw driver had to get some petrol. So he pulled into a station, and just behind the station there was a big banyan tree. And it was dark, but I could see the branches of the tree and what light there was. And I was just appreciating, it's a really big banyan tree. And I was looking at it, and then as looking at it, I saw there's a light in the tree. And that attracted my interest, and I was looking closer and looking from this side to that. That's the moon. The full moon was within the tree. So this is the example that you want to show someone the moon. So the moon is behind the tree, so you point the person's attention to the tree first. Now, the moon is transcendental to the tree. It's like Krishna is transcendental to the taste of water. But this is a process by which one's consciousness can connect with the moon nonetheless. The moon is not in the tree. The globe of the moon is not stuck in the branches of the tree, obviously. The moon is far beyond and above and much, so much vaster than the tree. But it is just a nice arrangement by which we can come to understand the moon. And so similarly, through the tasting of water, by following this authorized process, we can come to better understand Krishna. Why? Because the process is approved. That's the point. This is again deductive. It is based on authority. And mental speculation means the mind just does what it will. Prabhupada said haphazard guesswork. Let the mind go in its uncontrolled way, associating this and that. This is what the mind does, association. Just associating this and that and this and that and this and that, all in the mental plane. So this will just lead one further and further into confusion.
How we establish that Vedas are authority to be accepted?
How to establish? I mean, to demonstrate to others. Yes. And the answer to that question is by morality, or by one's example. Yes. Halena Parichiti. So, by in Western philosophy also, they say there are four departments. There is starting with logic. I've explained what logic is, systematic thinking. And then epistemology. Epistemology is studying how we know. You see? If there's sense perception, then examining how it works and how impressions of the senses are coming to the mind. So this is another department. Then metaphysics means things beyond the physics, literally in Greek. That there are things higher than what we see. That there are eternal principles, perhaps. And then the last department, the fourth department, is morality or ethics. And so it's the ethics which is considered to be the tangible proof that one is advanced in the other three. You see? If one is a good person, trustworthy person, honest, you see, then we think he has something worth hearing to say. You see?
That's why it's difficult to establish now, because these are not anymore in society.
Yeah, therefore Srila Prabhupada said, what did Prabhupada say? That he wanted the devotees, he said, to be loved for their honesty. So, Prabhupada also said, he was once, Srila Prabhupada defined, he gave a definition of a brahmachari. This is very interesting. He said a brahmachari is one who, when he appears on the street of a city, then rich men will come down from their skyscrapers. They'll come down, all the way down to the ground floor, out on the street, and come before this brahmachari and say, how can we serve you? That's a brahmachari. Because his purity is so impressive and tangible that others who are engaged in their, you know, busy in their materialistic affairs can instantly recognize that here's a saintly person.
But there are many moralists who are on the material platform. There are many moralists.
Yeah, mundane moralists. Srila Prabhupada said that is also not the point. Mundane moralist, he gave the example of Maharaj Yudhisthira, when Krishna wanted Yudhisthira to also tell Dronacharya that his son Ashwatthama had been killed. Actually, only an elephant had been killed in the war. So, because an elephant named Ashwatthama had been killed, the cry went up, Ashwatthama is dead, Ashwatthama is dead. And this was to strike Dronacharya in the heart that his son was killed. But Dronacharya said, I'll not believe it until I hear it from Yudhisthira. Yudhisthira is sadhu, he always speaks the truth. So then Krishna wanted Yudhisthira, you also say that Ashwatthama, his son, has been killed. But he couldn't bring himself to do it. Prabhupada said that he said sort of in a low voice, Ashwatthama has been killed, whether man or elephant, I don't know. Something like that he said. So Prabhupada gave this an example of a person who puts a mundane truth over the absolute truth, Krishna's desire. So that won't help. But still, anyway, when Srila Prabhupada says we will be loved for our honesty, then that is Prabhupada's order and we should follow it. Just like Krishna told Yudhisthira, say that Ashwatthama was killed. So Srila Prabhupada is telling us we should be loved for honesty. So it's not mundane morality. Alright, I think we need to stop now. So I thank you very much, and we'll continue tomorrow. First clearing up a few remaining points and then going further into this theme of purification. Looking, we'll start going into the nature of our material conditioned situation, the mind, the senses, material consciousness, how that has come about and how the jiva can get free of this situation. All right then, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai!